Good morning and welcome to the August 26th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on a crisp fall-like morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Good morning, Roger. Good morning, Park City.
And today on Mountain Money, we're going to start by speaking with Summit County Council members Melina Stevens and Candace Hart about the proposed emergency services sales tax.
Then Andrea Juskaitis of Sky Blue College and Academic Coaching will talk about empowering kids to help them reach their potential.
We'll also get a chance to speak with Sarah Irvin and Juliana Alley about last week's fundraiser, Pledge Drive. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Very few people find themselves waking up each day saying, goody, goody, we have a new tax to pay. But today we're going to learn about a new tax that involves the costs associated when someone gets stuck or injured while on a hike, or in the back or side country. Then the Summit County Search and Rescue is called to action, but who picks up the tab for that rescue? Melina and Candace, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, let's start with the big picture. Candace, talk to us a little bit about the cost of search and rescue and who pays for it now.
Well, there's several services, and thanks for having me on, everybody. There's several services that are paid for really out of our property tax. So when you think about the Sheriff's Department, and that's what search and rescue is a part of, that's one example where that comes out of the county budget. So when you have someone who comes in the town and visits us and something happens where they need help in search and rescue, which was called out 112 times last year, that was 22 times in the month of August alone, 97% of those calls are for people that live outside of the county. And currently, that budget is paid for through our property tax. And that may be the way to do it. The voters will have a choice here if they'd like to switch it to a sales tax. But one of the things we're looking at is within the sales tax, our numbers right now show us 67% of sales tax is paid for by people outside the county. So right now it all comes through our property tax, to answer your question.
Gotcha. Do you have the information on what the cost was back in 23 or 22?
For search and rescue specifically, or just at large?
For search and rescue, yeah.
Yeah, so search and rescue right now, as an example, this is a good example of kind of how a lot of these emergency services are essentially underfunded right now. So if you just replaced them one for one, you could do that, but you would still have an underfunded organization. So the county budget or the Sheriff's Department budget for search and rescue is about $345,000. Once you pull out a lieutenant's salary, fleet vehicles, those 112 missions or calls that I spoke of, they operate on an annual budget of $45,000. That's for all training, all equipment, food, clothing, everything. If you think about, one of the things the search and rescue team does is it is who's sent in when there's an avalanche, and this is even on the side country, the canyons at Square Top or Dutch Draw or back, I think a couple years ago, up in the mountains. But the first thing we do is we send search and rescue to make that recovery. And the very first thing you learn in avalanche rescue or avalanche training is that the first sign of avalanche danger is a prior avalanche. So think about it, if you have a budget of $45,000 and you're trying to send volunteers out to recover somebody and reunite them with their family, you don't even have enough money to send them to avalanche training to get their certifications. And so really organizations like that rely on a group called Friends of Summit County Search and Rescue, which through donations from the public is actually covering that gap or that delta. And that's because search and rescue, to be fair, is an unfunded mandate by the state. And that's another good example of this. The state passed a law that said EMS is now an essential service. So the county last year, and I'll let Melina take you through the details, but we had to step up and we're spending $4.5 million to fund EMS services. And as an example, I know this is gonna be, when people think of their property tax, they probably just sort of lump it. It's easy to lump it all into one thing and think, oh, the county raised my taxes. But actually the county council has not raised property tax since 2017. Tax increases we've seen have been either through home valuations or other line items. But the county essentially, since we haven't raised property taxes since 2017, and we've been hit by inflation like everybody else, which hurts all of us. We're operating on less and less money. So when we have to take $4.5 million out of reserves to cover EMS cost, you know, that has a really large impact. And we know that 58% of all EMS calls are for people that live outside the county.
Okay, so let me see if I can, Melina, can you help us understand, is there a distinction that we're talking about between EMS on the one hand and search and rescue on the other, and can you explain that?
Yeah, so EMS, or emergency services, would be anytime somebody calls 911 for a medical type emergency. So in many jurisdictions within our county, both law enforcement and fire would respond, or at least fire would respond with paramedics to ensure that the person that was experiencing whatever emergency is getting the proper medical care and or ambulance service to the hospital in extreme cases. Search and rescue is really more designed for those people that are recreating out in the Uintas or recreating, you know, backcountry skiing type situation, gets lost or gets into some sort of emergency situation. And so they are separate, related but separate. They have separate funding sources, separate individuals that are performing those services. They do work together in certain situations. But as Candace said, these are both unfunded mandates by the state legislature that we as a county are responsible for, but the state has not chosen to allocate any additional funding for. So we're trying to determine how to do that and looking at those options.
And this potential new sales tax, would that apply to both or just to search and rescue?
So the sales tax that is being considered will both apply to emergency medical services and search and rescue. It also can be used for fire protection, law enforcement, and solid waste landfill. So yeah, it is specified as far as what we can use it for, but it is a little bit broader than just EMS and search and rescue.
Yeah, I think it's good to know that it's, that's why the tax is called the emergency services tax. The four primary areas of focus are emergency medical services, fire protection, law enforcement, and search and rescue that Melina said. Mm-hmm. The list of things you can use it for is a little bit longer. Melina mentioned landfill, which would be true. So think about the impact of tourism just in our landfill through our hotels and our restaurants. We know that 45% of our landfill is food waste. And that's why, you know, you have the Community Foundation trying to divert that. But, you know, the tourism business affects us. And so take landfill. That's all funded through our property taxes. I think something that would be good for people to know. So we have a couple choices. You know, basically, if you want to fund these things, one way to do it is you raise property tax, right? You go, okay, the general fund, which is one line item in our property tax, you can increase that. And if we do that, we know that 100% of that impact is on the people of Summit County if you raise the property tax. Or you can do the sales tax. Really, the voter is going to get to choose, you know, like how they'd rather do this. If you go through a sales tax, we know that the majority of it, 65% of it, is paid for by people outside of the county. And it does not impact your groceries, like unprepared foods, no prescriptions, not things like gas. And you tend to get it in little bits at a time. But one thing that's also important to know, any money that's collected from this 0.5%, which is the proposed amount, has to be used to offset the impacts of tourism. So that's a very important piece. It's really, that's the purpose of this tax, would be to try to get people that live outside the county as much as possible to cover the cost of these impacts. So you couldn't, say, collect money and use it to pad a budget. You couldn't just make a department bigger or something. That department in these areas of emergency services have to draw a direct line from the impact to the amount of money, and that's how they get funded.
Candace, you said that 100% of the cost of a property tax would be imposed on Summit County residents. You're going to have to help me with the math here. As I understand it, non-residents who own property in Summit County pay approximately double the property tax rate of residents, and that, in fact, the majority of the value of Summit County property is probably owned by non-residents. So I'm having trouble with the 100% math. Wouldn't a property tax increase largely be borne by non-residents?
No, it's a misconception that's largely born out of a Park City municipality focus. Within the one city, within the entire county of Park City, 60% of the homes are listed as second homes. So you have 8,300 full-time residents in Park City, but we have 43,000 people in the county. So when you look at the county and you think about areas like Promontory, think about up in the canyons, There's all kinds of high dollar, high value property, but the 74% of the homes in Summit County are primary, and primary residents receive a 40% discount. So it's not double, and it's certainly not the vast majority. It's a misconception that a lot of people think of. I think it largely because we tend to think of the municipality of Park City when we think about this primary to secondary home ownership.
I don't want to get bogged down in the math, but in terms of the total property value in Summit County, I would still think that the point you just made would not really get you there.
One for you, Roger. This is a really interesting number that helped put into perspective.
Okay.
So if you do a 0.5% sales tax, that'll generate roughly $15 million.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to generate $15 million through property tax, you'd have to increase your general fund by 94%. So you'd have a 94% property tax increase is what the residents of Summit County. And then, of course, the county council would never do that, right? There's no way you're going to put a 94% property tax increase. So what you end up then is underfunding your emergency services, and you're right back in the same place.
And just to stay on the math, when you say 94%, there's a number of line items that I see on the property tax.
Yes,
what percentage of my total property tax increase would be associated with that, as opposed to the line item associated with the general fund?
There isn't a single answer for anybody, because everybody's property tax lines vary so greatly. So depending on what district, you could have a different fire district, different school district. Mm-hmm. There's different water districts. There's so many sublines that there isn't a single number.
Okay.
But you would have to generate the $15 million. It would have to be such a massive property tax increase that it would just be, it's an opinion of mine, but it would just be so punishing. I couldn't imagine why a council would do that.
Gotcha. Now, I remember a story back in the 90s about a skier in Southern California. He went out of bounds, had to be rescued, and got hit with a five-figure bill from the San Bernardino Sheriff's Department. Is search and rescue able to bill the rescued individuals directly to then offset this sales tax and or property tax?
It wouldn't make a dent in it, really. when you think about it, it'd be a radical number. But generally speaking, actually in the state of Utah, all search and rescues run through sheriff's departments. That's part of that state law I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But they typically don't charge, because then what happens is it becomes a compounding problem. Then the person delays reporting the call or reporting someone missing, and everything gets worse and then gets more expensive and it's harder. So the general thought is it's better just to get someone to call 911 as soon as possible so that you can resolve the situation. Because when someone's calling 911, remember, a lot of these things are medical emergencies. It could be missing people. It could be a whole range of things. You want to get the 911, the emergency services, into play as quick as possible to rescue the person, and it has less of an impact that way.
Gotcha. Melina, before we go, real quickly, let's go back to specifics. What are the voters going to be seeing this fall? How will it look on the ballot, and what is the choice they're making?
So on the ballot, it will indicate emergency services sales tax with an option to either vote for it or against it. With that, it would be voting for this increase of 0.5% of sales tax increase throughout the county. And that would again be on all products, not including grocery, prescriptions, and gasoline. And so that could provide residents with some options, essentially. So in the assessment, as we reviewed this, could provide residents with options, if going out to eat became an onerous thing for a budget, they could go to a grocery store. It provides some options that perhaps a property tax that is mandated, once there's an increase to a property tax, there's not a lot of options aside from payment plans and deferment. A sales tax provides some additional options for residents, or could. So this would just provide some opportunity for residents to say, yes, we want to pay for this through sales tax, or no, we're not into having that increase.
We've been speaking with Melina Stevens and Candace Hart about the potential new sales tax increase that will be presented to the voters of Summit County this November. Candace, thanks. Thank you. Melina, thank you. We'll be right back after this.
Okay, next up we have Juliana and Sarah, both here with KPCW, to give us a summary of the success around Pledge Drive Week. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Of course. So Where are we at with the pledge drive?
How do we do last week, guys?
Well, it was tremendously successful, and we're so grateful to everyone who listened in, called in, donated online. We just wrapped up counting as of midnight last night. And when it's all said and done, KPCW raised just over $342,000 over the last week, which is incredible. We are, again, just blown away by the generosity of this community. And I mean, that included about $25,000 in donations that came in over the weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, that's not typical that we would have that much over the weekend. So people were definitely hearing the call over those 4 days that you have until Sunday night, and people were getting some things done on the weekend. We appreciate it.
And so basically we almost hit our goal. It was within, you know, I'm sure Juliana, the accountant, could figure out a way to round it up to our goal. but you know, why do we do this? I mean, why do we need to raise this kind of money? What kind of costs are we trying to meet?
Sure. So we're trying to run a radio station, which is turning into something more than a radio station, right? We've got a pretty significant website. We've got an app. We've got presence in the community, not just that you listen to, but that you feel, hopefully, when we're out and about at various in-town events, in the community events. So we have to cover those costs. Our headcount has increased pretty significantly over the past several years, mostly in the news team, which we're excited about. But our programming department is larger. Our development team is larger as well. So in order to be an attractive employer, a place where people want to come and work, we have to offer a competitive compensation package, which includes not just salary, but benefits and perks and things. But then there obviously is the internal production costs to produce shows just like this, Mountain Money, This Green Earth, all of our PA shows, as well as the external programming that we provide you guys with, whether it's BBC or the NPR programming, et cetera. But then there's also the equipment. Like, I'm looking around this room. I don't know. This room's probably 18 grand.
Oh, I think it's more than that.
And then we do more than that. And exactly.
Plus job.
Yes. Right. It's our people that we value the most. But all of this equipment, you know, and with the digital age, you know, things become obsolete quicker than they used to. So we have to make sure that we're using the latest and greatest and upgrading and keeping all of the equipment that we have in good working order.
All right, so I'm a noob here with KPCW, so is it really that expensive just to do radio, Sarah?
Well, you know, as Juliana mentioned, we're really more than just radio at this point. You know, of course, our roots are in public radio, and for the past 44 years, that's where we've been, and that's where you will continue to find us. But you can find us in so many more places, and we like to say that we're evolving beyond just our terrestrial signal, and we are working very hard to deliver the news and services that our audience demands wherever and however they want to receive that content. So online at kpcw.org, it's always free to access. We don't even ask you to register when you go on our website. There's no paywall. There will never be a paywall, and that's really unique in the in the media world. Certainly today. We're really a multi-platform digital media outlet at this point. You can stream us anytime you go anywhere. You don't have to have a radio anymore. I know there's a lot of cars, newer cars these days, don't even have an FM radio, but they do certainly have streaming, and so you can find us on any of the streaming platforms. We have a mobile app that we are excited to, I think, you know, look at sort of mobile app 2.0 going forward, and that's something that we really need to fundraise for. And, you know, we've introduced a lot of new services over just the past 6 to 12 months. You may have noticed when you tune into the Local View that Randy Barton is no longer reading the news. We now have our news team working very hard on producing professionally produced newscasts that air twice every hour during the Local View. So you know you can tune in and get your local news in that 3 to 5 minute recap at just a few minutes after the hour and at the bottom of the hour. And we're trying to create that regularity for our listeners so they know when they can tune in and get KPCW news. We've also recently introduced kpcw.org en Español for local news in Spanish. We know that a significant portion of our population does not speak English, or if they speak English, it's limited, and we want to be able to deliver them local news that keeps them informed and connected and feeling very much part of this community, because they certainly are an incredible part of this community, and we want them to know what's happening in their backyard and the resources that are available to them. And so, you know, these are new services we're extraordinarily proud of, but they cost us money, and we have to keep fundraising, and we have to keep expanding what we do in the community in order to stay relevant.
Okay. So what's next for the station, Juliana? What do we got coming up?
Coming up, well, we are working on hiring our Spanish language reporter. As Sarah mentioned, you know, we're expanding all of that, those offerings. And we are trying to finalize the general manager search. I think that the board will have an announcement in the next couple of days. And digital presence. We have had a digital specialist with us the past 2 months, I guess I would say. And so a lot of you have noticed we've got more robust presence on social media, definitely a lot more fun stuff on social media. And so we're going to be expanding that role as well.
Okay, we're going to leave you alone for a while on fundraising, but what's the next big fundraising push?
So, of course, we never stop fundraising. If someone feels so moved and they feel like donating right now to KPCW, you can always do so. Same goes with our major donor program, the Broadcasters Club. We never want to dissuade anyone from joining at any time of the year. But we will do our next big fundraising push, of course, will be Live PC, Give PC, which is a little bit later this year. It's mid-November, November 15th. And like every nonprofit in town, we will be participating in that. And then, of course, year-end giving is becoming a bigger and bigger opportunity for us to engage donors. And we know there's a lot of people in town who, you know, that's the time of year when they're really assessing what do they have the capacity to give and to whom do they want to give that those year-end gifts. And so KPCW will be available for that as well.
And we'll be talking more about year-end giving generally here on Mountain Money, sort of the tax implications and the way to plan. And not only to facilitate people giving to KPCW, but just for their general financial planning.
Excellent. Yes, thank you very much. Well, thank you very much, Juliana and Sarah. I think we're going to cut away and we'll be right back.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Mountain Money. We are here with Andrea Giskaitis with Sky Blue College and Academic Coaching. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's start with the big picture. What is this business? What do you do?
Oh, boy. So really my interest really lies in helping students transition from high school to college. But also I'm realizing that there are a lot of post-secondary options out there too, just besides college. So helping students transition into career options as well. I'd say my primary focus though is working kind of one-on-one with students to help them with their college essay writing, with their choices of college lists and making sure that they find a right fit for them. And then also just sort of navigate some of the challenges of the college application process.
Interesting. So do you also coach them for the ACTs and or SATs?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, I think that's probably one of the bigger topics that parents talk about these days. The ACT-SAT has, I think it even started like in the 1920s from Princeton College Board. And things have really, really changed over the years. I mean, there have been all sorts of questions about whether or not it's like equitable and so forth. And so really, I'd say the big shift happened right after COVID. And a lot of schools, simply because they had to, because students couldn't take the test because they were at home, became test optional. And so these schools became test optional, meaning they even became like the tests weren't even taken. And so they've stayed with that a lot to make it test optional. And so for the student who does really well taking a multiple choice test, the ACT and SAT still is a really good way of trying to gauge adding to your application, your essay, and your teacher recommendations, another good way to kind of gauge chances of getting into a good college. But I think what's important to note is that there are more and more test optional schools available than ever before, and they're staying that way. And so for the student who really struggles trying to get that, you know, perfect ACT score, I think it's 36, you know, there are a lot of schools like the Ivies or, you know, you have to really apply with a 32. I think students get really afraid of those test scores, and so they are applying to more schools that are test optional.
Yeah, my sense is that the competitive schools, the pendulum has started to swing back.
Yeah.
And that while the more competitive schools sort of moved away from test taking, partly because of COVID, partly because of other social factors, my sense is it is swinging back, and the competitive schools are more and more requiring tests again.
Yeah, absolutely. I just read an article this morning, and it, you know, it's the Ivy schools. Of course, not everyone is applying to an Ivy school, right? And I think I was reading too, there's 5,900 college and universities out there in the United States that are all degree-seeking, you know, universities. And so, 5,900, there's so many options. And, you know, Princeton, Yale, Dartmouth, Harvard, Brown, I think they're getting back to wanting to have SAT, ACT scores available in the application, but the majority of these schools are staying with test optional.
I want to take one step back and get you to talk a little bit about your journey. How did you end up, tell us a little bit about your background, how did you end up finding this business?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for asking. I have been an educator and English teacher for 29 years. And so, really have come full circle because this is where I started my teaching. I was actually coaching high school soccer for the girls Park City High School soccer team. And then I started getting into substituting and teaching, got my credential, got my master's at Westminster College in Salt Lake. And I have taught for 29 years as an English teacher, primarily focusing on junior and senior students, AP Lit, AP Lang. And when I found that I spent so much time working with these students on their college essays, and then I was working in conjunction with the college counselors of the various schools that I worked at, I realized I just really loved working with this group of students and sort of coaching them, literally coaching them kind of through this process of trying to make the right decisions and the right fit for them, and obviously helping them find their voice when it comes to writing an essay. So I just moved back to Park City. I was in Colorado for the last couple years, just moved back, and I just realized that I want to get into college coaching and working with the students, not only in this community, but just sort of nationwide. And it's just been something that I've really wanted to do for a while, and now I have this opportunity to do so.
Well, welcome back to Park City.
Thank you so much, yeah.
Now, your website shows different packages available to students, from hourly coaching to all 4 years of high school coaching. Which one is the most popular?
Oh, gosh. Well, I would say probably the most popular right now are the families who are calling me and saying, my student is a senior and they haven't even started writing a college essay yet. And so I've been working quite a bit right now, which is really my love, is one-on-one with students, helping them find their voice when it comes to writing their college essay, which is, the Common App calls it a personal statement. And really what it is, it's sort of a narrative essay, helping the student write a story about something about their lives that is worthy of getting noted by an admissions officer. And so I'd say that is what I'm focusing on right now, is helping students essay write and then also find colleges that are kind of a good fit for them. However, what I really would like to see is I'd like parents to start kind of wrapping their head around this idea of that it is a four-year process. And I say that because if I could get a student in ninth grade, at some point, parents might think, oh my gosh, it's so early, but it really isn't, to start thinking about how a student can understand the importance of having consistency in something, whether it's consistency in a job or consistency in finding or like playing a sport for the next 4 years. A lot of admissions officers are looking for students who show that they've stuck with something for a while. And so if I can get ninth graders to understand that the signing up for student council and staying on it for 4 years, or playing on a soccer team for 4 years, is a really good thing. And also starting to prepare for their classes in a way that kind of puts them in a good place for college. That that's a great, you know, start to the plan.
I can't imagine anything much more challenging than trying to persuade a ninth grader to think that far in advance.
Yeah.
I couldn't think past the next weekend when I was that age. Let's talk a little bit about your process of when you have a student that signed up for coaching, and you're looking at the student, and the student says, I don't know where I should be thinking about schools.
Mm-hmm.
What process? How do you go through what is the analytical process you go through to try to help make basically what you do is college matchmaking, right?
I think for me the difference right now is because I'm not a teacher teaching these students. The number one thing is, of course, I have to get to know the student. And so I'd say the very beginning is just getting to know the student. I mean, there's various surveys and things of that nature that they can take. But I do a consultation interview where I kind of interview both the parents and the student to kind of make sure it's the right match. And that would mean like that we're aligned with the same values of what we're both kind of here to do. I'm here to coach them through. I'm definitely not here to promise them that they're going to get to college. But then
I think the people who did that ended up going to jail, but that's
making sure I'm very clear on that too. Yeah. But then the second meeting is an intake meeting, and it's an hour and a half to 2 hour meeting of just really kind of getting to know the student and asking them a lot of questions. And some of the questions are pretty simple and basic. I mean, one of the questions is, location. I mean, you know, especially coming from mountain towns, you get a lot of students that are interested in experiencing a school that has maybe different kind of weather, right? So like maybe warmer weather. But, you know, some students are like, I just want to go to a school back east because I want to experience what it's like to live in New England or something like that. And so location is always important to talk about. Of course, size of the school. So anyways, there are lots of questions that I ask the students. And then, of course, I ask them more personal questions about, like, what kind of learner are they? You know, how do they learn best? Can they do well in a lecture-based environment where there's potentially 500 students in a class, or do they do better in a small Socratic method, you know, kind of like classroom? So just a lot of questions like that. And then, you know, part of my responsibility is to start tapping into all of these schools that maybe they don't even know about,
mm-hmm.
right? There's so, as I said, 5,900 schools that students, sure, they might have heard of University of Colorado, right? Because that's kind of a big school, but they might not be familiar with Colorado School of Mines or Colorado College or, you know, thinking about schools back east. You know, there's so many great, tiny little liberal arts colleges that might really be a good fit. So it's sort of my responsibility to help look for those schools for them and then have them do some research. And then, you know, we start moving from there.
Yep. But how many colleges should a high school senior be applying to?
Yeah. I mean,
what is it, 5? Is it 15?
Yeah.
50?
Great question. And so I think there's a sweet spot. And here, my suggestion is going to be 8 to 10. I mean, sometimes even 10 seems a little bit too much. So, and I say it for these reasons. And I think a lot of the parents and students who are currently involved in this process know these three words. There are reach colleges, there are match colleges, and then there are your safety colleges, right? And so in my head, I sort of say, and I'd say a lot of counselors would probably say something similar, is that two safety schools, you know, safety school is about 80% chance that you're going to get into this school, right? You've looked at your GPA, you know, you have good teacher recommendations, et cetera. So 80% chance. So that two safety schools, about 3 to 4 match schools, right? So the school that you're pretty sure you're going to get in. And then the third school is a REIT school. I absolutely think students should definitely be applying to REIT schools. But those are schools that, you know, the likelihood of you getting in is more difficult. But I'd say 2 to 3 REIT schools. So if you kind of do some numbers, you know, it's anywhere from 8 to 10 schools.
What's that cost? Applying to 10 schools.
For an application?
Yeah.
On average, I would say, an application these days is about $100.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll just go to the UC system. There are quite a few students in this area that do apply to the UC system, so University of California. And so that would be UCLA, UC Santa Barbara, UC Irvine, UC Berkeley. So they do kind of a nice package deal, or you can apply to, you can check off like 2 or 3 or 4 of those colleges on one application and then turn it in. And so it's kind of like a, you know, you could do 4 for 1 type deal. And so there's that. But on average, $100, some maybe $75. Yeah.
Now, what would you say to somebody who's only, you know, a high school senior who's only going to apply to one school?
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to that person, Ellen?
Well, I just, you know, it's the whole putting your all of your eggs in one basket is a little bit of concern to me. I mean, look, if it's a safety school and they absolutely 100% just feel, well, I don't even think 100% is like an accurate number, right? I just, you never know. And so I would definitely, just to be safe, and I was having this conversation with a student yesterday, I would at least have three schools.
Aha. Now, we're talking about college.
Yeah.
College is not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I'm a high school senior and yeah, my grades aren't that good. I don't really care about class. I don't want to go to math or English, but I love woodshop. Do you coach kids on how to take their skill with woodworking or metalwork or whatever and get them into a trade or tech career? How does that work?
Well, that is such a great question. I'm so glad you asked it. I mean, my husband would be right now smiling because he actually worked at a school in California called Trade Tech High. And he's a builder, but one of the things that, you know, I'm noticing, and my daughter went through a similar path. She went to an academy, a fashion academy, so it's not like a 4-year conventional college, and so now she's in a sustainable fashion program. But I mean, think about all of the different kinds of trades that are desperately needed. Let's look at just Park City. You know, you need plumbers, you need electricians. I mean, we couldn't live and survive comfortably without people in those fields. And so I absolutely want to tap into what the student wants, right? What they think they're going to be best fit at. We definitely have students who aren't interested in going the conventional route. Currently, I have some students who I'm helping with who are at Salt Lake Community College simply because they weren't prepared to go to a 4-year college. And so right now, to get their GEs out of the way and then give them some time to kind of grow up a little bit, you know, and figure things out and experience life a little bit and then apply to a college later. I mean, there are culinary institutes, which are becoming quite popular. I'm so surprised at how many students are now applying to like flight school and becoming like going through like a different route where they're getting their pilot's license and then maybe going to like a specific flight program rather than like a 4-year college. So there's so many other options out there that exist that I really think it's important for people to start seeing those options as well.
And so I guess part of your job is to learn about all these different institutions, from the, particularly if you're going to be able to advise on these vocational options.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been working on for, I'd say, because my daughter sort of took that unconventional route. You know, the last 4 or 5 years, I've really been cognizant of that as available, you know, something available for students too. So yeah. Yeah, I just think that we kind of need to realize that there are so many options out there that not everybody has to go to this conventional route. And there's really great ways of making money and being successful that don't necessarily mean that you have to go to a 4-year college.
Now, as a business show, I have to ask, can you give us a sense of what kind of fees are associated with your consulting operation?
Well, sure. So this is... I need to be a little bit careful because, I mean, it's sort of an ongoing organic thing. I mean, I will be, you know, we'll admit that I probably the best thing for me to say is that I really want to be able to meet with the needs of the student and the family. And so while I do have an hourly wage or hourly
rate,
I guess not wage, you know, like if there's a family that knows that I'm going to just meet with them 5 times, I might be willing to, you know, make a couple of, do a little bit of negotiating there. I also, the hourly rate does go down. If you commit to a longer package, then the hourly rate does go down. And this is always, I think, a tenuous conversation just amongst all independent counselors, because across the country, the rates vary. You know, New York City, my rates would be a lot higher. San Francisco, they would be higher. And so trying to, you know, create a rate that is going to get you one-on-one attention, I think is going to be, you know, a very good, adequate amount.
Excellent. Just to wrap up, I want to circle back to the Common App you mentioned, just so parents can hear it. What is the deadline for the Common App?
Great question. So In fact, I think it's important to note that if you are interested in applying to an early action school, early action, which a lot of students are these days, mm-hmm. That's November 1st. So, you know, this is crunch time for a lot of schools. So Common App is accepted by a lot of colleges across the country. And so I would say like December 15th is sort of a common regular deadline for most schools.
Okay.
And so really this is the crunch time, as I said, for seniors to write their essays and figure out their lists and get the application in.
Gotcha. And the essay is very important, I assume.
It is. I mean, and I will say this, that the weight of the essay is about 25% of the entire application process. So that's a quarter of your application.
Interesting. How would you, I assume you would chat with, when I'm saying chat, I mean ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Will a kid just into ChatGPT and say, write me a college essay?
Right. Well, of course, I mean, they can do that. That's a huge conversation these days. I mean, as an English teacher, that was my number one concern, right? Like, how can you get a student to turn in an essay that hasn't been written through AI, right? And so, I mean, here's what I'm going to say, and I really believe in this. I believe that I can help students find their voice and that. And I have read so many essays that are ChatGPT AI essays, generated essays. I myself have done them to just do some sort of like, you know, just kind of figure out like what it looks like. And I do think that there is a very specific kind of way in wording in which AI kind of shows up. And so I feel like I can kind of read through that. And certainly an admissions officer would be able to tell. I really believe that. So to help a student feel confident to find their own voice and write their own sentences with their own ideas is really, really important, because I'll tell you, if an admissions officer reads an essay and they're like, this sounds like it's, you know, AI generated, that is going to be to the detriment of the applicant.
But maybe it could be helpful if I have no idea where to start, I don't know where my voice is, I can throw it into ChatGPT, it'll give me an idea, and they say, okay, let me use my voice to rewrite this, and it sort of gives them base. Would that read like ChatGPT?
I would say to do it the other way around first. I would say, this is the English teacher in me for sure, but this is, you know, stream of conscious writing, or however you want to write it out. Like, I have a template that I provide for my clients where it really gives you an idea of how to start writing. And so, you know, write however you write. And then, you know, if you really want to kind of put it into ChatGPT or, you know, an AI program, then they might make some changes. And then you can kind of say, well, that doesn't sound like my writing at all. And then you can make those changes. But I would say first start with your own writing and then think about doing that, you know, later.
Excellent. Andrea, thank you so much. It's skybluecoaching.com. You can find her there. Hang with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. Our scheduled guest has not yet appeared, but we are lucky that we have a little more to cover with Sarah Irvin, KPCW's development manager, if you're not tired of hearing from her.
There's so much Sarah on the radio right now. Thank you, though, for having me back, Roger and Kevin.
Never too much, Sarah, never too much. Okay, so we're going to talk some more about the mechanics of the pledge drive.
Yeah, and it's unique here. We've actually had some of our peer institutions around the country ask us how we structure our pledge drives, because it is so different than, you know, a typical public radio pledge drive where you have hours upon hours of the same voices asking for money. We try to make ours fun and inclusive for the whole community. And we've really found that the partnership with both sponsors and nonprofits throughout the community is what makes it so lively and also incredibly beneficial for us, but really the nonprofit partners and sponsors as well. So we invite about 24 folks from around town who represent local nonprofit organizations or businesses. We pair those businesses with the nonprofits to serve as the sponsor for the hour. And what we're doing during that hour, of course, was raising money for KPCW, but those nonprofit partners also had the opportunity to earn free underwriting credit with KPCW. Those underwriting spots, you just heard one here. Underwriting is the public radio term for advertising. And that that underwriting credit really saves those nonprofits a lot of marketing money throughout the year. So when you hear a nonprofit spot on our radio, it means that you know, they've had to spend some money to get that on there. And so when they come on and partner with us during Pledge Drive, they can earn up to $4,000 in free underwriting credit that they can then use for the following 6 months of the year. So it's a great partnership that we've developed. And we are really pleased to say that actually almost all of our nonprofit partners last week maxed out the underwriting credit that they were eligible to earn. We had one that fell a little short, and that's okay. They're still going to get some credit, but almost all of our partners did, and they will be redeeming that credit with us over the next 6 months.
Excellent. So that's the Pledge Drive. Is there are there any other sources of funding for the station?
Oh, absolutely. And I should really quickly, if it's okay, I'd like to mention the sponsor role in the Pledge Drive as well, because businesses, you know, they can't earn free underwriting credit. Those are FCC regulations. We can't just go giving that away for free. But businesses really step up in this community and help us throughout the year, partnering with the station as underwriters and sponsors of programs. You hear them recognized here on Mountain Money every Monday morning. But I want to give a special thank you to our major level sponsors for this last Pledge Drive. Extel donated at the platinum level to really help the entire drive. They did not come on air, but they wanted to support the entire drive. So thank you to Extel. And Columbus Pacific Development as well was a platinum level sponsor. And that level sponsorship just makes a tremendous impact here for KPCW. We also had more gold sponsors this year than ever before. That's at the $2,500 level. And a big thank you to Singerman Real Estate, Monterey Technologies Incorporated, Park City Mountain through their Epic Promise Grant, and I'll get to that in a second, Kevin, with other sources of funding, but the Park City Board of Realtors, Deer Valley Resort, Grand Hyatt Deer Valley, one of the newest properties in town, and then Promontory Foundation, also through a grant that we received from them. So grants are the other another major source of revenue for us. We do get a significant grant every year from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but that I say every year, it's not necessarily guaranteed because that is congressionally directed funding. And particularly in some of these volatile political years, we can't always count on Congress to fund. it's big laughs here. We can't always count on Congress to fund what they've funded in the past. And so we always do want to be very mindful of the fact that our CPB grant is in the range of $200,000 to $300,000 per year. If that were to disappear, ooh, we would have to make that up through community support.
What percentage of the annual budget is that?
Hold on, I've got...
What's it about 15%?
I think 15%? Our grants account for about 15% of our funding. We also receive a tremendous grant from Summit County through the RAP tax program for arts and culture. That's another huge source of funding for us. That's a rigorous application, and I know a lot of folks around town apply for that money as well. So we're very grateful to Summit County. And then we also do get other grants from entities like the Epic Promise Foundation through Park City Resort, Promontory Foundation, the Park City Community Foundation through their Community Fund. These are all local grants that we apply for every year, and we're grateful for the continued support. But again, we never want to take any of this for granted, so we're going to continue building out our services and expanding what it is that we deliver to the community in hopes that both donors and granting agencies believe in what we do and want to invest in our future.
How unusual is this model of parents?
Very.
when you guys go to, NPR nerd conventions.
Mm-hmm. Public Radio Nerds Unite.
Public Radio Nerds Unite. These people actually, they have coffee cups that says, I'm a public radio nerd. I mean, I'm not just being vituperative here. When you go to these conventions, does anybody else do it like we do it?
I have yet to meet another station that does. We've talked a lot to other stations about how we do it with this model, and it really does. I think it's unique, but it's also something that other stations are looking if they are able to emulate it. We're lucky that we're such a small station, but with such a generous donor base, so we're uniquely positioned to be able to run our pledge drives more inclusive of the whole community. And another thing that we are really proud of is that partnership that we do have all year long with these nonprofits and business sponsors.
Now, you ran through some thank yous.
I did.
We should also talk about the thank yous to the many businesses that give us those incredible premiums.
Thank you, Roger. You're absolutely right. We are able to give fantastic thank you gifts throughout the weeks of our pledge drives, thanks to the generosity of local businesses who contribute those gift cards or gift certificates, other items that we are able to offer our donors as ways of saying thank you for donating to KPCW. I would be remiss if I didn't thank those who gave a straight donation. Some of these are through in-kind, which is something that, of course, if you're in a business in town and you're interested in learning more about in-kind and underwriting with us, I encourage you to reach out to Brooke Ahlberg. But those that gave straight donations, I mean, that's through the goodness of, you know, them being very generous in town. Alberto's was a new one this year. Big Dipper up here on Main Street donated. We have Flight Boutique. We have... Midway Mercantile down in Midway. We have, of course, Bill White Restaurant Group, Shabu Eating Establishment. Those are longstanding partnerships that we have. But it's always so nice when we have new businesses join us and want to donate those gift cards to us.
Excellent. Yeah, I just saw Kevin from Shabu walking in the back door.
Hi, Kevin. Yeah, the Shabu ones, I think those disappeared early this year.
They always do.
Yeah, they do. Stein Erickson was another one that came in and disappeared within the first day. Those brunch certificates, man, those went quickly. Skier's Buffet.
I got one last year. I wasn't quick enough this year.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Roger. They were gone.
Okay, so we mentioned that coming up we have Live PC, Give PC, and then year end. Are we doing anything unusual for year end?
No, but be on the lookout hearing from us. We'll be reporting back to you on the new services that we've added in the fourth quarter this year, and we look forward to your support.
Thank you, Sarah. We'll be right back after this.